Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We don't tend to think of artists as soldiers, or at least of art as a weapon of war. But it turns out there was a little-known Army special unit comprised of artists and advertisers, writers, and PR professionals who waged a unique kind of misinformation and deception campaign against the Germans in World War II. The Ghost Army of World War II, a recently published book by Rick Beyer and Elizabeth Sales, tells the story of this top-secret unit that used inflatable tanks and planes, sound effects, and illusion to fool the Germans on the battlefields of Europe. Their story is being developed as a Hollywood movie by the producers of American Sniper, including Bradley Cooper, who starred in that film. And there's now a bill in Congress to award the Ghost Army, as they're called, the Congressional Gold Medal. The campaign's being led by my guest, Rick Beyer. Because of the secrecy of their mission, the Ghost Army has received little official recognition, and as the members of the unit age and pass on, this effort is becoming more urgent. Welcome, Rick.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you on. Why don't you just start by telling us who the people in the Ghost Army were and what they did?
Well, there were a whole variety of people in the Ghost Army, artists being a big group, but not the only group. There were also sound engineers and people who came from Hollywood, and there were all sorts of kind of regular GIs and soldiers as well. And this group, it had an official name, the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops, about 1,100 men. And its mission was to impersonate other American units to fool the Germans about where those units really were, how big they were, where they were going. And so it's an impersonation mission. And as you say, they're using inflatable tanks. They're using sound effects. They're using radio deception and doing other stuff as well. And this is their mission on the battlefields of Europe. You know, sometimes people confuse this story with the D-Day deception that happens before D-Day. But this is really happening after D-Day on the battlefield within sometimes a stone's throw of the front lines. So it's a really incredible story.
Yeah, and I guess it could be confused with propaganda, but that's typically, you know, dropping leaflets that try to sway a population one way or the other, or broadcasting radio broadcasts that are intended to change minds, right? But this is a totally different thing. It was multimedia in the full sense of today's word, right? And a very interesting creative process.
Precisely. It's a multimedia deception. So imagine that the 6th Armored Division is going to be, we want to attack in one place, but we want the Germans to think that we're getting ready for the attack someplace else, 20 miles away. So we have the Ghost Army there pretending to be the 6th Armored Division so that the German intelligence people who are listening to the radio are hearing transmissions that sound like the 6th Armored. Their reconnaissance planes see tanks, you know, dug in the forest. Their frontline outposts are hearing the sounds of tanks moving in at night. So it's really a deception operation. Think of it as a traveling roadshow of deception with the German Army as the audience and life and death stakes. And then you pretty much have what the Ghost Army is about.
So you said they started operations after D-Day, which I guess puts it after, what, June 1944, right? But in what battles and specifically in what fronts did they end up operating?
So this unit operated only in Europe. The first elements of it, there were actually a few soldiers who landed with the troops the day after D-Day. They had planned on doing some deceptions relating to the landings, but it didn't work out. So the first actual deception that they did started on D+8, June 14th, with a small group of deceivers. They got the whole unit over there later in June, in early July. And then they were involved in 21 different deceptions. So when Patton is trying to race across France, the Ghost Army is trying to make it seem like he's going in another direction. Similarly, when Patton was attacking the fortress city of Metz on the German border, the Ghost Army is kind of filling in a weak spot in his line to prevent the Germans from getting behind him. They are involved in the Battle of the Bulge. They are involved in the crossing of the Rhine. So they really are traveling with the American units, mostly the 12th U.S. Army Group that's crossing Europe. So they're involved in Normandy, involved in the Battle of Brest, involved in various fighting along the front in eastern France, western Germany. And then eventually in the crossing of the Rhine. So they kind of see it all.
That's really wild. I mean, as I said in the outset, I hadn't heard of this, and I bet most people haven't. Why don't you give us an idea? You know, we have a general idea of the kinds of things they did, but maybe talk about some of the very specific props and things that they used and some of the techniques that they actually used to kind of fool the spies, I suppose, for the most part.
Well, you're trying to fool spies, but you're also trying to fool enemy intelligence. You know, one of the first rules of this kind of mission is you have to figure out how does the enemy gain information? Where are they kind of receiving information? What are the channels that they're watching, if you want to compare it to television? And then you want to project your false information over those various channels. So sort of the first obvious one is if the enemy has aerial reconnaissance or even people in church towers with binoculars, you want to be able for them to see something. So the Ghost Army had inflatable tanks, inflatable trucks, inflatable artillery, inflatable jeeps, even inflatable spotter planes, so that they could create a visual tableau that looked like a real infantry division or a real armored division to enemy observers. Similarly, if you had an armored division moving in overnight, you would hear that, right? It's not, they're not quiet. You can hear that 5 or 10 miles away. So they had half tracks with giant speakers mounted on them. And they actually had put together a world-class collection of sound effects records, probably the best military sound effects records of all time. And they used these to create and mix together different audio shows for depending on what scenario they're doing. And they're playing them. And you can also imagine, Court, if you have, you can kind of time this to make it seem like the sound is moving down the road. So if you have a one sound truck starts at, you know, 10:15 and the next one starts at 10:45 and it's 3 miles away, and the next one starts at, you know, 11:15 and it's 3 more miles away, it's going to seem like the sound is moving down the road. And this was very, very convincing. Another thing that they did, which we haven't even really touched on yet, is they developed a type of deception called special effects, which involved impersonating the soldiers and officers in other units to fool the German spies. So if the Germans had left spies behind in some towns in France, a little bit behind the lines, they would set up, if they're pretending to be the 75th Infantry Division, they would set up a divisional headquarters. They would have somebody pretend to be a general. He would be zooming around in a jeep with two stars on it and guards with submachine guns, and all the soldiers would be wearing patches of the 75th Infantry Division, so that they're sort of trying to flood the zone, to use a football term. They're really trying to put that information out to anybody who's watching that that's the 75th Infantry Division. So you put all these different kinds of deception together and you get the multimedia effect that the enemy is convinced that the unit is really there, when in fact that real unit might be 10 miles away or 100 miles away or not even in Europe yet.
Who actually built the inflatable tanks and other large specialized balloon-like creations? This wasn't something that you could go down to the local department store and buy. So was there a factory that was turning out a lot of these big realistic inflatables like this?
So the inflatables were designed and built by a consortium of rubber companies in the United States. So the effort was led by U.S. Rubber and their plant in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, which is, since I'm in Lexington, Massachusetts, that's about 50 miles from here. But they had other plants in this area, plants in Scranton, Pennsylvania, Columbus, Ohio, and other places. And a lot of these dummies were made the people who physically made them were teenage girls, because, you know, the guys are going off, they're being drafted, and they're going off to war. So it's teenage girls working after school, putting together these things in the rubber factories. And they were told that they were making targets for target practice. So even there, they're keeping a secret. But it's interesting, I discovered that at this one plant, this was considered so important. They were making barrage balloons, which are used to hold up the ends of steel cables. You see them in all the footage of the invasions and stuff, all those balloons overhead. Yeah. They're holding up cables to prevent low-flying aircraft from attacking a fleet or attacking a city or whatever. They actually stopped production of the barrage balloons, shut down that production line, and converted it over a weekend into a production line that would make inflatable tanks, because at the end of 1943, this was such a huge priority to be able to get these done and get these in the hands of the Ghost Army before they went into action.
It's amazing. It was such a big deal and we've never heard of it. So once they got to the front lines, I guess they were deflated and packaged up in a box or something? How did the guys inflate them and then deploy them? Did they carry them out and blow them up like you would a beach ball or what?
Well, there's a lot of stories about that, some of which are not fit for radio. But anyway, So the tanks are all in these duffel bags, and they're in a, you know, they've got trucks. So they've got maybe 20 or 30 of them in a truck, and they weighed about 90 pounds. And so you bring them out, and they had air compressors. One of the soldiers said to me, he said, look, we had air compressors. When things were going very well, we used the air compressors. When things were not going so well, we used these pumps that were like bicycle pumps. Mm. And then when things were going very badly, we inflated with our mouths.
Wow.
Basically, with an air compressor, they could inflate a tank in about 20 to 30 minutes. And of course, they're not doing one. They might be doing hundreds, dozens or hundreds. And the other thing that it's important to remember is you can't just inflate a tank and let it sit there. For if you should look at aerial reconnaissance photos of tanks, the first thing you're going to notice is that they all have tank tracks leading up to them. Because a Sherman tank weighs 40 tons. It makes an impression in the ground, a pretty good one. So if you're going to be setting up fake tanks, now you need some combat engineers, which they had, who have a bulldozer or two, who can go in as you're setting this up at night. Of course, this is almost always happening at night. And they're putting in the tank tracks so that when you look at it from the air in the morning, it looks realistic. If you have artillery, you need to have spent artillery shells sitting around, you know, camouflage netting that's camouflaging everything, but not quite perfectly so that the Germans will see through the camouflage. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole really artistic sensibility, which is one of the reasons that they wanted artists to work on that visual camouflage, and that not everybody doing the visual camouflage were artists, but there were a lot of artists in that part of the unit.
Hey, you mentioned that they set up kind of fake headquarters, and I know that some of these Ghost Army people were theater set designers. Did the Ghost Army personnel actually build some of the deceptive scenes themselves that would look like a headquarters and that kind of thing? Did they get involved in, you know, figuring out how to design and build them?
Well, they didn't build any of the inflatables,
right,
that they used. They certainly were involved in creating the different deception, visual deception items, like a phony headquarters, like the patches. Let me give you a couple of examples. We're impersonating the 75th Infantry Division tomorrow. We all need 75th Infantry Division patches. Now, we can't get them through the Army bureaucracy for 3 weeks, right?
Yeah, sure.
So they had a factory section that were essentially counterfeiters. They made counterfeit patches. They made them out of tent canvas, and they designed and printed probably something like 40,000 phony patches over the course of the war. What they also did is they sent out guys to artists, to different units, even when they, sort of in their downtime, when they weren't doing deceptions, they put together information sheets, which they called poop sheets, which had all of the different designs for, you know, how does a certain division, how do their MPs, what do their helmet markings look like? What do the division signs look like? What does a headquarters for this unit look like? What are the markings on the jeeps look like and stuff? So that if they were then called upon to do, you know, the 26th Infantry Division or the 5th Armored Division, they could immediately kind of go to the files that they were setting up in advance and know what that stuff would look like. And then, yes, they would be involved in setting up a phony headquarters. I mean, again, think about it. It's sort of observation. Well, what makes something look like a headquarters? For one thing, it has a huge amount of wire going in and out. So now they've got to get their engineers to lay wire in and out of the phony headquarters, even if the wire doesn't go anywhere, mm-hmm, right? Sure. But it's got to be there so that you see it. You got to have people and personnel moving in and out who are staff officers. So you have to have all of your own officers, when sometimes you're enlisted men, impersonating staff officers. They impersonated generals sometimes. They have a major who's impersonating a general. And, you know, Court, this is against Army regulations. This is a clear-cut violation of Army regulations. And they were one of the officers in this unit, Fred Fox, who's a great figure in this story, junior officer in this unit but had a lot of ideas. He wrote this impassioned memo, and he said something like, you know, we have to be able to carry out these impersonations. If you're going to impersonate a woman, bosoms can't be forbidden. Right. So you need to have the ability to get the little details right in order to be able to create the convincing deception.
Yeah, it's theater. So, you know,
putting on a show. That's what they were doing.
Well, as we know, you know, most artists, like most actors, don't become celebrities and household names. But out of this Ghost Army, are there any of the members of the unit whose names we might know today?
Well, there were a few who became quite well known. Possibly the most famous would be the fashion designer Bill Blass, who was a 21-year-old kid from Indiana when he was in this unit. And he was already filling his notebooks with women's fashion, kind of sketching stuff that he saw when they were in Paris. But he was very well known. The artist Ellsworth Kelly, who died within the last year, who is considered really one of America's foremost artists of the second half of the 20th century, won a presidential gold medal. Pretty big guy, minimalist artist, created very kind of modern minimalist art. He was in this unit. If there's anybody in your audience who's into wildlife and birding, they may know the work of Arthur Singer, who illustrated the book Birds of North America and many, many, many other books on birds and wildlife. And he did way back, like 30 years ago, he did the Birds and Flowers of the 50 States postage stamp series. So those are the guys who are the best known, but there's all sorts of other interesting connections. There's a guy in the Ghost Army who designed dresses for Marilyn Monroe. There's another one who shot the album cover of many album covers for rock groups, Art Cain. There's another one who was a co-creator of the Munsters TV show. So you really have, you know, in this very small group of people, a huge amount of creativity. And the Army, I think, did a great job in harnessing that creativity for the military use. That's really part of what makes the story great, is that, as you said at the beginning, it's all people who maybe you don't expect to be contributing to a war effort. Maybe you're not thinking that creativity is part of fighting a war. And yet it is. And these guys did it. And by doing it, saved the lives of, you know, who knows how many people, but probably tens of thousands of American soldiers.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Rick Beyer, who is the author, the co-author of a recently published book called The Ghost Army of World War II, which is about a special unit in World War II who was operating in the European theater of war to basically create deception and misdirection in the German troops regarding troop movements on the American side. So, Rick, you said they got out in front of Patton's army and were kind of really in the front, which is surprising. So how close to the front lines were they? And did they ever engage in actual firefights, which would get kind of interesting?
They operated sometimes as close as about a quarter of a mile from the front line, 400, 500 yards.
Whoa.
They did take artillery fire. They took casualties. They had 3 men killed and several dozen wounded over the course of the war. They did not ever get into a situation where the Germans attacked them. Then I think they were very lucky in that regard. And I think, you know, they also were hopefully projecting enough force that they made it seem like you wouldn't want to attack them. But that's really, I think, what is kind of the amazing thing about this story, is that this isn't like something happening, you know, back in England or 50 miles from the front line or something. These guys are, in many ways, they're not living the life of frontline soldiers. And every one of them would say, no, those guys are the real heroes, not us. But they are often, as I say, a quarter of a mile, half mile, mile from the front. They are often taking artillery fire. They are putting themselves in some very risky situations. And basically, the only weapons that they have are, you know, their M1 carbine or their M1 Garand and maybe a 50 caliber machine gun. So they can't really defend themselves against any concerted enemy attack. And so they generally tried to, if they were thought they were in a situation where there were going to be attacked, they would try to pull out. And most notably, during the Battle of the Bulge, the Army took this whole unit and pulled it back about 100 miles, 50 or 100 miles, most of the unit. Part of it did a deception. But they were trying to protect them so that they would have them later. And it's actually one of the real clues as to how important the Army considered this unit. Because at the time of the Battle of the Bulge, Eisenhower was having a desperate personnel shortage. So he could have just said, screw the deception mission, I'm sending these 1,000 guys into the front because we desperately need them. They were putting cooks and typists and all people like that. Instead, they said, nope, we're pulling these guys out of the line and sending them back because we want to preserve our deception capability.
Yeah, I understand it. Well, I'm just thinking it must have been interesting if some of this artillery ever did hit the inflatable tanks, for example, rather than blowing up, they would just deflate. I mean, did that ever happen?
Well,
and if so, did the Germans
see it? Here's what you need
to
know about how that worked. The inflatable tanks are actually built on a skeleton of inflatable tubing.
Mm.
So imagine that it's 4-inch tubing, and you've kind of got a skeleton that roughly makes the shape of the body of the tank. And that skeleton is divided into sections so that you're only inflating small sections at a time.
Okay.
So that it's a little bit protected. If a piece of shrapnel comes in and hits the tank, it's not going to blow up like a balloon that you pop with a pin. It's certainly going to sag. There's going to be problems, but you can go in and repair that. So you're setting up all these dummies. Then you're digging trenches for yourself so that if the artillery comes, you're hopefully somewhat protected against that. And you're working on repairing them when there's problems. And again, the dummies are going to be somewhat camouflaged. I mean, obviously, they're not pretending. They're not using the dummies to pretend that these tanks are 10 minutes away from launching an attack. They're using them to suggest that we're sort of building up forces in a particular area. And there were times that a lot of soldiers told stories about saying, you know, whether they're working with the dummies or working with the sound trucks, that, you know, they got word that there could be trouble, there could be enemy headed this way, and we need to pull out. And they would skedaddle when that happened. I mean, this is because it was very important that the Germans not find out about this unit, because then that would destroy its effectiveness.
It would blow its cover.
Interestingly enough, the sound trucks in the unit, for example, were all equipped with explosives charges. So they could pull the pin on it and have 30 seconds to get away, and it would blow up the entire sound truck, the half track, so that the Germans didn't know, you know, what they were doing with this.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did the Germans ever figure it out?
No, they didn't. Now, that's the simple answer. There's no evidence that the Germans ever realized that there was a deception unit operating against them. That doesn't mean that every operation was a slam dunk success. Some of them were clearly more effective than others. I think that their last operation, where they made it seem like the U.S. Ninth Army was going to cross the Rhine River in one place, and in fact it crossed 10 miles away, is a deception you can really point to and say there's solid evidence that worked and drew German forces away from the point of the real attack. Mm. And there's other deceptions that's also true of, but there's still other ones that we just don't really know. We don't really have firm information on. Maybe the Germans didn't buy it, but that doesn't mean that they knew then that there was a deception unit. It just meant that they were looking at their intelligence. They drew different conclusions than what we wanted them to conclude.
Yeah,
so
maybe,
no, they didn't know that these guys were out there trying to pull the wool over their eyes every day.
Or maybe at some points they might have been scratching their heads like, that was weird, what happened there? But they never did figure out exactly. So.
Right. Well, and of course, they got a lot of stuff going on, because the Germans for most of this time are in retreat, constantly being pressed by Allied forces. And so they're not necessarily, you know, it's a very confusing time. And so you can't necessarily sit back in a quiet mode and really contemplate. I'm sure there were times they were wondering, but they didn't ever quite put it all together.
Rick, are there any... let's say maybe time for one particularly funny or interesting story that you might know of.
Well, we were talking about inflatables, and early on in their time in Europe, they were setting up their inflatables, and they would always put a security perimeter around to keep civilians away, but they were not really very good at it yet because they hadn't been there very long. And a couple of French civilians on bicycles got through as they're trying to set up the inflatable tanks. And one of the soldiers, Arthur Shilstone, was now trying to shoo these folks away. And he said, you know, they weren't looking at me. They were looking over my shoulder. And what they thought they saw was four GIs lifting a 40-ton Sherman tank and turning it around. And they're looking at me and they're looking for answers. And finally, I told them, the Americans are very strong. So that is my favorite Ghost Army story.
Yeah, that's a good one. I thought for a minute you were going to say that they had four guys with their mouths attached to the flanks of the tank blowing on it. This is what we use for fuel. It's American air.
Yeah, exactly. Hot. You knew Americans could make good use of hot air. So.
There you go. Perfect. All right. Well, we are listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Rick Beyer about the Ghost Army, who were basically people who are exercising weapons of mass deception, I suppose you could call it, on the European battlefield by setting up all kind of creative deceptions of different kinds, including inflatable tanks and jeeps and artillery pieces and so on, and putting on basically stage shows to bamboozle the German spies and the German military about what was going on the American side. Rick, shifting gears a little bit, there was a PBS documentary about the Ghost Army in 2013, and now I understand there's a Hollywood film in the making. Where does that stand?
Well, some of the producers of American Sniper optioned the documentary in the book, because I wrote and produced the documentary. And they're working on making a movie, and it's Hollywood, so it takes a long time, and nobody tells me anything about it.
Sure.
But I know that they hired a screenwriter. Henry Gayden is writing a screenplay, and I think it's probably close to done by now, and they're having all sorts of meetings, and I suppose if there's some big piece of news, I'll get to hear about it. Bradley Cooper is one of the people involved in producing it and is, you know, at least at this stage, interested in playing a role in it. But I always feel like when I talk about this, it's kind of like it's a lottery ticket. You know, mm-hmm. I have no idea if they're going to end up making the movie. I hope they do. And they certainly seem to be very serious about it. I mean, there's some very important people involved. So I'm just kind of crossing my fingers and waiting to see what happens.
Yeah, I know the way that works in Hollywood. It's always a series of rolls of the dice, and it can go any way. But, well, I tell you, we just have a minute or so left, Rick, so why don't you tell us about the Congressional Gold Medal and the push to have it awarded to the members of the unit?
Well, we are working to have Congress award this medal, and we have introduced legislation in both the House and the Senate. I think we have about 45 congressmen and 4 or 5 senators supporting us now. We actually need to get 2/3 of the House and 2/3 of the Senate to co-sponsor the bill in order to be able to have it go to committee. So I'm trying to get anybody who's listening and who's moved by this story to reach out to their congressman to get them to support that, or their senator. And we have a website, ghostarmy.org, and people can find out more there about how to do it and sort of the process of trying to award this honor to the men of the Ghost Army, who I really think deserve it because they used creativity to save lives, and that seems like something really worth honoring.
Well, they sure did, and it's an interesting story, and I think it's interesting enough that it will be a movie, so watch for that too, everybody out there listening. Again, as Rick just said, the website is www.ghostarmy.org, and the book was published in January 2016, The Ghost Army of World War II. It made the Wall Street Journal bestseller list. You can buy it at the website, ghostarmy.org, or on Amazon. Or you can listen to the audiobooks version of it on audible.com. In fact, the first chapter of the audiobook is available for free on ghostarmy.org, and you can download or rent the PBS documentary from 2013 from iTunes or Netflix or Amazon. Well, Rick Beyer, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety and talking about this very interesting story.
Well, I'm really delighted to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
And good luck with the Congressional Medal push. It's really great that you're organizing and being the prime mover for that. And I guess it's going a long way downstream toward being a real deal, so that's good.
It's bipartisan, and it's something that we hope to make happen.
Thanks again, Rick, and thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.